Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Bush Social Security privatization of accounts when we come back. You know, when the federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of the early opponents of that tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. This year, the average American family will work all the way through May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, when you compare this to the plight of medieval serfs, says economist Daniel J. Mitchell, they only had to give the lord of the manor a third of their output and they were considered slaves. Now, what does that make us? And this income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. The income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth. And that's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. President Bush has proposed a limited privatization of Social Security accounts as the solution, or a solution, or at least a partial solution, to the shortfall that Social Security is going to come up over the next 20 or 30 years. Bush originally called it a crisis. Democrats have taken him to task on that word crisis and said it's only a long-term problem. I guess crisis is in the ears or the eye of the beholder. I would call it a crisis. Anytime that you have a business model that is paying out more than it's taking in, in my business career, I always called that a crisis. And that was something that had to be addressed. It had to be addressed now. It had to be solved now. There had to be a plan in place now to solve that problem now. That's the way I've always operated my business. Evidently, I was kind of dumb or something. Maybe I was a crisis monger or I was a hysterical nitwit. Well, I didn't have a problem at all. Businessmen take shortfalls pretty seriously. When we get into a place where we're losing sales or losing market share or taking in less money than we're paying out, we start thinking about cutting the payroll, cutting expenses, cutting costs. I mean, when you have to meet the payroll, I used to have a payroll of $10,000 a week. And when I only had $8,000 in the bank on Thursday, I got very nervous about writing $10,000 worth of checks on Friday. And I knew that I had to write those $10,000 worth of checks or I wouldn't have a crew on Monday to go to work. You know, a businessman doesn't just say to his employees, well, we got 75% of your paycheck, so let me give you 75% of it, and then we'll talk to you next week about maybe we can give you the balance. Your employees expect to get paid. When you write the payroll, you also have to have the money to pay the payroll taxes. That's another $1,600 or $1,800 in addition to the $10,000, at least it was when I was writing checks. 16%. So I'd have another $1,600, $1,700 to pay that. Otherwise, Mary Trudeau would jump on me and threaten to close my business down, seize my bank accounts. They didn't just say with a kind of a blasé whisper, a wave of the hand, that, well, we got 75%. That's what Ted Kennedy told Charlie Rose the other night. He said, Social Security won't be broke. It'll still have 75%. It'll be able to pay 75% of its obligations when it runs out of money. And I mentioned to you last time that from my experience, the first time that you can't meet your obligations, you're bankrupt. Now, that was the definition that I'd always been taught. Now, maybe I didn't have that right. Maybe there's a new definition today. Maybe I didn't understand the definition of bankruptcy. In fact, America's banks today, by the definition set down by the Small Business Administration, would all be bankrupt. They only have a 5% reserve, if that. Many of them don't even have 5%. The old reserve requirements used to be up around 20%, 17, 16, 17, 18%. They lowered that to 5%. If I went into the Small Business Administration and I couldn't show them that I had something like 60, 70, or 80% equity in my business, they wouldn't loan me money. When you get down to 50% equity, SBA won't loan you any money. What would a bank do if they went into SBA and said, we got a 5% equity in our business? Could they qualify for a loan? I'm not sure that these politicians, and Paul Begala belittles George Bush. He calls him a panty waste, well, in so many words. He says, you know, he's lived all of his life as a privileged fella, never succeeded in business, and if it wasn't for the family name and his father in the White House, he'd never have gotten anywhere. I think Begala's probably right. The history of George Bush, Begala says that George Bush has got to be the lightest weight president in the history of America. Dumb as a box of rocks. Well, I don't think he's as dumb as a box of rocks, but I think he is a lightweight. No doubt about that. So again, I got to agree with Paul Begala on that score. I'm not sure that Al Gore would have been any better, and he would have scared me even more than George Bush. But George Bush isn't a conservative. He spent more money than every president before him. He's run us further in debt than any other president. There's nothing conservative about George Bush. He has spent more money, run up more debt than Franklin D. Roosevelt. I mean, this guy is worse than Roosevelt. So if you didn't care much for Democrats and Democratic spending, I can't for the life of me understand why you'd like George Bush. Now, I imagine Bush has got his good points, and I don't want to sit here and argue politics because it's a nowheresville argument. It's just one fool contending with another fool over politics. But what I thought I would do is to review Paul Begala's book. It's called The Case Against George W. Bush, and it's entitled, Is Our Children Learning? You know, it should be, Are Our Children Learning? But it's entitled, Is Our Children Learning? I suppose George Bush must have said that somewhere. Published by Simon & Schuster, it's $12. Go to Amazon.com or go to Barnes & Noble or someplace, pick up a copy. I think you'll be glad you did. It's very enlightening. I was very enlightened by this liberal. I read liberal papers. I read Mein Kampf. I don't think I turned into a Nazi because I read Hitler's autobiography, but I like to read some of this liberal press from time to time. It kind of sharpens my wits a little bit, you know, and it makes me ask questions. You know, are these people really up to speed on what's going on around them? And I'm not sure that a lot of these people with PhDs in government service, if they had to meet the payroll every Friday, if they had to go out and sell their products in the marketplace and pay those taxes, would speak so blithely about raising taxes. Now, the Democrats' solution seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, send me an email, but I was listening to Ted Kennedy the other night on Charlie Rose, and Kennedy said, and Bogala says the same thing in here, he says, you know, we can solve the Social Security shortfall by simply taxing the rich. All right, so over the last 57 years, we've raised the Social Security tax 22 times. Now, let's carry this out to its logical conclusion. The system is not economically sound. We looked at that the last time. It consistently spends or pays out more money than it takes in, and the solution has always been raise the taxes. So let's do that. When Social Security began its career, began its the program in 1935, the tax was 1%. Pretty soon it doubled to 2%. Pretty soon it doubled to 4%, then to 8%. Now it's at 16%. So the next time it doubles will be 32%, then 64%, then 128%. So in three more doublings, it's going to take 28% more than everything that we all produce in the country. I'm going to contend with you that long before we get to the third doubling from where we are today, Social Security is going to pass into history. I don't believe for a minute that the people of America can pay 128% even if they all believed in Social Security. I think that by the time it reaches 32%, and it's at 16 now, by the time this thing doubles to 32, I don't think that the economy, the nation, or the people can stand it. And let's assume that they can. Do you think it could stand the next doubling from 32 to 64? Now, this thing has doubled five times in 75 years. Let's just try that and see how many years are in. From 1935 to 2005, 70 years. So let's take 70 and let's divide that by 5. That means that every 14 years it doubles. That's 5% a year compounded. It's called the rule of 72. So if you take this rule of 72 and 14 is the magic number, then 5% is the interest. Can you see that? Just try it. Take 72, and then divide that by 5, and then you come up with 14.4. That means that it doubles every 14.4 years. Social Security has doubled five times. It went from 1% in 1935 to 2% in 1950, and then 4% in the 60s, and 8% in the 70s, and that's a 16% now. So you divide that out, and it comes out to 14. 14 into 72 is 5, thereabouts. All right, so that means then it's got three more doublings until it hits 128. So every 14 years it doubles. So 14 years from now, which is just exactly what Dick Armey said, he said in the year 2018, this thing is going to be out of money again. It'll be paying out more than it's taking in. And it'll be insolvent again, and we've got to have another solution to the problem. So we'll raise the taxes again, and we'll raise the taxes again, and we'll raise the taxes again. If we only raise taxes, then 14 years from now, in 2018, you're going to be up to, or 14 years after 2018, you're going to be up to 32%. 14 years after that, you're going to be at 64%, and 14 years after that, you're going to be at 128. Now, That's the history of it. Now, you're going to sit there and tell me, well, just because that's the way it's run for the last 70 years doesn't mean that that's the way it's going to run for the next 70. Seems like to me the burden ought to be on you to show us, well, what's changed. And last time I asked you the question, I said, is the demographic profile changed? Are there going to be from 3.2 to 4, 5, 6, 7 people paying in over the next 20 years for everybody drawing out, or is it going to continue on like it's been going? The Congressional Budget Office says that it's down to 3.2, headed for 2 to 1, and then 1 to 1 by the year 2020. I don't know who to believe. You know, I'm just giving you the numbers that come in, and then they come from the Congressional Budget Office. Are they lying to us? Is it President Clinton that's been lying to us? Begala says it's Bush that's lying to us. Well, was it Ted Kennedy that was lying to us? I mean, somebody's got to be lying here. You can't all be right. Bush says it's a crisis. The Democrats say, oh, no, it's not a crisis. But everybody's agreed that the thing is running out of money and that it's not mathematically viable. It's a Ponzi scheme. Bush says he can save it. He's going to save Social Security. I don't believe that for a minute. I don't know what he's got in his mind. You know, maybe it's something subversive, or maybe it's sincere. Maybe the guy, honest to God, believes that he can save Social Security and be another FDR. Well, here's the history of it. During the early 30s, millions of Americans were out of work and out of business and into the soup kitchens and the bread lines. So FDR had ordered them to surrender their gold and silver to his brain trust and trust the brain trust with running their lives. Well, a California doctor named Townsend proposed that the government give $200 a month to every American over age 65. Now remember, 200 bucks was a lot of money back in the 30s. Of course, this was to be financed by taxing the scarce dollars from what was left of the producing workers. It was, in short, a transfer of wealth from the working producing people to the non-working consuming elderly population. Socialistic schemes were not provided for in the Constitution of the United States, and they were totally alien to America. However, in 1932, the chairman of the Communist Party, William Z. Foster, wrote in his book titled Toward Soviet America, "The establishment of an American Soviet government will mark the birth of a real democracy in the United States. Wages will be sharply raised. There will be development of the system of social insurance against unemployment, old age, sickness, accident, and so on a full wage basis. The establishment of free medical services and so on." But just think, only 3 years later, our Congress fulfilled part of this prophecy by saddling us with the biggest con game ripoff in the history of mankind. We call it Social Security today, the Ponzi game, or the government-directed chain letter. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Begala would deny that. It's not a chain letter. I have never met anybody involved in a chain letter that said, yes, I recognize that it's a chain letter and I want to get fully involved. Everybody that I've ever talked to has always denied it. I wouldn't expect those proponents of Social Security to admit it. But just because they deny it doesn't make it untrue. So I showed you last time what a Ponzi scheme was from the guy that originated it. Ponzi. Charles Ponzi, 1921. And how it worked. Social Security works exactly the same way. All right, so you can call it what you want, but it's economically unviable. It doesn't meet the math test, and Mr. Begala claims that George Bush cannot meet the math test. He's right. He's right. The Bush proposal does not meet the math test. I mean, it's just mathematically unviable. It's an insoluble problem. You know, I kind of liken it to having a jar that's about half full of jelly beans. And we put two jelly beans in from the outside, and then we take one jelly bean out. And then we put two jelly beans in, and we take one jelly bean out. We put two in, we take one out. You can mathematically predict that at some point in the future, the jelly bean jar is going to be full and running over, and you can't put any more jelly beans into the jar. On the other hand, we could put in one jelly bean and take two out. Put in one jelly bean and take two out. Put in one jelly bean and take two out. And we could mathematically predict with certainty that at some point in time, the jelly bean jar is going to be empty. Now that's where we are with Social Security. At some point in time, this thing is going to be empty. The argument isn't over whether or not it's going to be empty, but when is it going to be empty? And I'm sitting here on the sidelines saying, well, if this thing is going to empty up at some point in time, it's going to disappoint a lot of people, isn't it? And the people that are putting in the jelly beans are in hopes of getting jelly beans out, aren't they? And aren't they going to be disappointed? And aren't those the young workers that we're taking the money from today and paying it over to the older retired workers today? And aren't the young workers then going to be disappointed? Aren't they going to have a benefit reduction? If, in fact, they don't have a total benefit surprise and get nothing back. I mean, I'm just throwing out the same argument that the Democrats are using today. They say, well, at some point in time, it's got a problem, but not now. And their solution is to raise taxes. Well, that's the solution that we've used all along, to raise taxes. And yes, that's a viable solution. We can continually raise taxes until we finally tax everybody 100%. Then what are you going to do? At that point in time, won't there be a benefit reduction? I mean, come on, guys. The thing needs to be fixed. It's broken. It needs to be fixed. Doesn't it? From the beginning, Social Security has been sold to the public as insurance. 15 years after it was created. In 1952, a Social Security pamphlet entitled Insurance for You and Your Family. It said, your account number on your Social Security card identifies your old age and survivor's insurance account. Your card is the symbol of your insurance policy under the federal Social Security law. Well, now I've got news for you. The Social Security card in your wallet, take it out and look at it. Like the greenbacks in your wallet, they're both nothing more than pieces of paper with colored ink on them. Neither has any value, and they're only symbolic of the faith that you have in your federal government. And I can assure you that you will have a difficult time trying to survive on faith in our government when you try to pay your bills with Social Security when they're only giving you 75% of your benefits. Now, the Social Security Act, passed in 1935, only provided for pension payments to retired persons age 65 or older, financed exclusively by payroll deductions. The deductions went directly into effect on January 1, 1937, at 1% of the $3,000 earned, or $30 per person per year. All of this money was to be invested in government obligations of the United States and credited to a trust fund and used for no other purpose. However, this allowed the government to borrow Social Security money as fast as the funds came in, replacing them with government promissory notes, which are nothing more than colored pieces of paper worth absolutely nothing and backed by no more than your faith in the United States government. And therefore, money to pay Social Security debts would come from general revenues, and the debt in the Social Security account would simply be altered by a bookkeeping entry. The constitutionality of Social Security was immediately challenged before the Supreme Court. Social Security lawyers knew that if the Supreme Court could be convinced that Social Security was insurance, the Social Security Act would be struck down as unconstitutional because the Constitution does not even remotely give the government power to sell insurance, much less compulsory insurance. So, the Social Security Administration lawyers told the court, moreover, the Act creates no contractual obligation with respect to the payment of benefits. Did you get that, boys and girls? The Act creates no contractual obligation with respect to the payment of benefits. The Act cannot be said to constitute a plan for compulsory insurance within the accepted meaning of the term insurance. And they went on to tell the court that these are true taxes, and their purpose being simply to raise revenue. The proceeds are paid unrestricted into the Treasury as internal revenue collections available for the general support of the government. Now, this is the Social Security Administration talking. And they were telling the court that Social Security was not insurance, but in fact just another tax designed to promote the general welfare of the American public. On this basis, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Act. The very same day, the very day that the Supreme Court issued its ruling, the chairman of the Social Security Administration, Arthur Altmaier, issued a statement, and here's what he said, quote, "The decision validated the federal old age insurance program contained in the Social Security Act." Now, amazing, isn't it? The very same day that the Social Security Administration convinced the Supreme Court that Social Security was a tax, they sold it to the public as insurance. Now, Social Security is not insurance. It's a social welfare scheme. So says Fleming versus Nestor. Well, Social Security receives no funds. Social Security funds are collected by the Internal Revenue Service, which is responsible for collecting this insidious graduated income tax, advocated by the father of socialism and author of the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx. It's the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a heavy, progressive income tax. Now, if you choose not to contribute to either, you will be jailed. Now, Al Capone called it protection. Our government calls it contribution. I say, either way, you're being robbed. The old age insurance program was barely in effect when Congress began expanding the program, and it soon became the Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance Program. Added to that program were survivors of workers who died and benefits for disabled workers. New groups of workers had to be added to the program in order to fund or pay for these increased benefits, or the program would have become bankrupt. It was normally extended to groups of young workers who would have to pay for many years before they would be eligible for any benefits. However, by 1981, over two-thirds of the nation's workers paid more into Social Security than they did any other tax, including federal and state income taxes and their local property taxes. Now, it has been difficult for Americans to believe that there are no reserves, that there are no funds that are being held in trust, that there are no numbered accounts similar to your bank account or your checking account, and that persons already retired are simply being paid from current general revenues collected from persons working today. It's been that way from its inception. But Social Security to this day has more than 80 little brochures. Just go into your local Social Security office and pick up the little brochures, and they tell you to this day that it's insurance or assurance, or they call it your account. So your income tax is in reality a little higher than you think. If you double your deduction for Social Security and then add it to your income tax, that gives you the true income tax picture. About one-third, about 33%, 16 for Social Security and 17 for income tax. You know, you don't really think for a moment that employers see the money they are required to pay as their contribution now, do you? Honest to God, do you believe that your employer is contributing out of their pocket, out of their funds, out of their profits to your retirement and Social Security? I tell you, boys and girls, if you believe that, you're dead wrong. And that's because the money is programmed towards your salary as an expense when you're hired. So as an employer, and I'm going to pay you $10 an hour, I just add $1.60 an hour to that. $11.60 is what we're paying you. So when payday comes along, I take $1.60 and I put that over in a pile, and then I make your deductions and I add it to that pile, and I write you a check, and I write a check to the Treasury Department, the IRS, and pay your tax and mine. An employer is nothing more than a tax collector. As an employer, I was a tax collector, and I collected all of the funds from our customers, and you, dear worker, did all the work, produced all of the revenue. I took $10, and then I took $10, and I took your deductions out of it, and then the other $5 was to cover overhead and expenses. No employer ever contributes a penny to a working family or a workman. Never. Now, it's a salary expense, no matter what ledger line you post it to. Employers do not pay a share of your Social Security. They simply raise prices to cover expenses. And the same is true for taxes. No employer, no company like General Motors or IBM or anybody else ever pays a penny in taxes. They only collect that money from their customers and pay it over to the government as taxes. Employers are in reality tax collectors, not taxpayers. Consumers pay all the taxes. And all of you laboring people are the consumers. By 1955, outstanding obligations for this program were estimated somewhere between $200 billion and $1 trillion. And this at a time when the value of all of the property in America combined, public and private, was less than $300 billion. Now, the Indianapolis Star recognized the problem as early as 1955, when the newspaper reported, quote, under existing law, no American can possibly have paid more than $600 in premiums before collecting on his Social Security, and yet all those collecting it can receive as much as $18,000 in benefits. This has created an obligation on the books of the Social Security Administration of something in excess of $200 billion. If private insurance companies functioned the way Social Security has, the government would have prosecuted its officers for fraud. Now, that was as early as 1955. 20 years after the inception of Social Security, the Indianapolis Star said, hey, listen, if a private insurance company operated this way, they would be put out of business. And I'm just telling you right now, that's exactly correct. It's that way in 2005. There's no private insurance company in America that can take a dollar in premiums for an annuity that they don't give a dollar back. Social Security, for the wealthy, takes five and then gives one back. And if you're a blue-collar worker, they're going to take $2.73 and give you back $1. And if you're a minimum wage earner, they're going to take a dollar and give you back 68 cents and charge you 32 cents for the service fee. No insurance company can do that. Now, Social Security is economically unviable. And if it were economically viable, it wouldn't make any difference who or how many belong to it. You can forget about Mr. Bogala or Ted Kennedy, Republicans or Democrats or any combination of the two, ever saying to the American public, we're going to give you freedom of choice. If you want to opt out of Social Security, you can. And if you want to stay in it, you can. There will never be freedom of choice with the privatization of accounts or with Social Security. You can't. It won't work without it. As a matter of fact, it won't work with compulsion, and it won't work without compulsion, but it's going to work longer with compulsion than without. So you're going to be compelled to participate, whether you like it or not. And I say that that's criminal, that's theft. That you're taking my property from me against my will and over my objection. I don't want to participate in Social Security. Fortunately, constitutionally, you can drop out. But if you're working at General Motors and you're living from paycheck to paycheck, you can't opt out. You can't work for these corporations. You can't work for wages without having a Social Security number. So you're locked in. Only those of us that can feed, clothe, and house ourselves in private business outside of the public government corporate program can do this. The only freedom available is to entrepreneurs, traders at law on a cash basis, without recourse to standard dollars, lawful money. We can do it. The rest of you are locked in. And if these people were honest, if Mr. Begala and George Bush and Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter and all the politicians and Dianne Feinstein, Barbara Boxer, if they were honest, they would let you choose. But they don't. They haven't, they can't, and they will not ever let you choose. And I would contend that without your right, without your ability, without your capacity to choose, you are not free. Call it what you want, but that's not freedom. Compulsion is tyranny. Pure and simple. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports, and the sources or information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. And I'm sure that Mr. Begala will agree with that. I don't think he's going to recommend the Law Hour. Most of the authors and publications cited on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. So I'm not endorsing Mr. Begala's views, and I'm sure that he does not endorse mine, which is fine, because the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. We're reviewing a book by Paul Begala, published by Simon & Schuster. We're on Chapter 8, Social Insecurity. The price of the book is $12. I highly recommend it. All right. Barron's for April the 26, 1965, quotes a Social Security official as follows. He said, "Continued general support for the Social Security system hinges on continued public ignorance of how the system works. I believe that we have nothing to worry about because it is so enormously complex that nobody is going to figure it out." Get that? Published in Barron's, April 26, 1965. One Social Security official, he said, "It's so complex, nobody's going to figure it out." In 1974, the Social Security Administration told Senator Curtis of Nebraska the cumulative deficit would exceed $60 billion by 1979. A study by the Congressional Budget Office said that That was a little low and should be more like $63.5 billion. Well, in 1975, President Ford predicted that the redistribution programs in this country will be eating up more than half of our gross national product within 20 years. His budget director, Roy Ash, further explained that these programs were steadily moving us toward a socialistic welfare state, and the trend may be irreversible. He said it would eventually lead us toward a steadily declining standard of living, as in England, where he pointed out they have less and less year after year. In 1975, Warren Shore wrote, "Social Security, the Fraud in Your Future." The Social Security Commissioner, James B. Cardwell, said in 1975 that Mr. Shore maintains that the federal planners and bureaucrats and congressmen have deliberately attempted to hide the truth about Social Security from the American people. If this is true, this would indeed constitute a formidable conspiracy, unquote. In 1975, Social Security took in about $60 billion from 100 million workers, but they paid out to 32 million people over $72 billion in benefits. Now, of course, that's a $12 billion per year deficit, and it was to grow even larger. So by 1977, Congress could no longer avoid the trouble that Social Security was in, so they passed a new law. In an attempt to save the sinking ship, they increased deductions every year for the next 10 years. So the solution in the 1970s was, we'll raise taxes, which they did. That's the only solution to Social Security from 1935 to 2005 has been to raise taxes. George Bush is the only one so far to come forward and say, okay, let's solve this problem. I'm going to propose individual accounts. Whether that will solve the problem or not is conjectural. The Democrats say no, it won't. The Republicans don't know. George Bush hasn't said, I don't believe it for a minute. I don't believe it because I learned how to count when I was 37. And after I learned how to count, I can see that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme and it's insoluble. Insoluble. The solution to a Ponzi scheme is to stop it, put it out of business, shoot it, kill it, get rid of it. And remember, Paul Begala said right at the very beginning, George Bush is a Republican and Republicans hate Social Security. Mr. Begala, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I hate Social Security. I hate it for what it means, what it stands for, and what it's done to me personally. And I hate having my money taken from me against my will, over my objection, and given to somebody else. I hate it. And I hate not having the right to choose for myself whether or not I want to participate. I hate it. I can't speak for George Bush, but I can speak for George Gordon. By God, I can tell you, I hate Social Security. I hated it so much I opted out of the damn thing. And boy, am I happy. I saved $140,000 from 1978 to 2002 or 3. That was $140,000 that I felt was better spent by George Gordon on something that I wanted to do. Here I am in the year 2005, 65 years old, and I'm not eligible for Social Security, can't draw Social Security, I'm not entitled to Social Security, and thank God every day for it. Now, President Carter, he signed the bill. He signed this bill. Congress enacted it in 77. Here's what Carter said. This bill ensures the solvency of these funds for the balance of the century. And I did that in 77. Hell, the thing was broke by 1982 again. It only solved the problem for 5 years. Then Reagan came in. And what was Reagan's solution? Raise taxes. That's been the solution. From Democrats and Republicans, all have the same solution. Raise taxes. Now, give Bush credit. He said, we got to fix the damn thing, but let's not raise taxes to do it. Well, okay, score one for Bush. And I mean, you know, maybe this guy's got a plan to bail it out. But I think Social Security is more like the Titanic. I think we should be working more on how do we save ourselves from the sinking ship rather than how do we save the sinking ship from sinking. I don't think you can save Social Security any more than you could save the Titanic. That's my personal opinion, for whatever it's worth. Well, President Carter said this bill ensures the solvency of Social Security for the rest of the century. Listen to that statement again, boys and girls. President Carter, a man from college, a man with a degree, a man with letters after his name, says, I've signed the bill and it saves Social Security for 23 more years. My God, he hasn't solved Social Security's problem, has he? It's still got the same problem. In the year 2000, it's going to be insolvent again, isn't it? You know, not a one of these presidents, from Roosevelt to Bush, has ever solved the Social Security problem. And that is, for every bean you put into the jar, you're taking two out. That isn't going to work forever. This isn't rocket science. That was President Carter. Now, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland puts it this way. They said the government has borrowed every penny of the Social Security reserve, and they've spent it. The workers' cash was replaced by government IOUs, and like the public gold in Fort Knox, their money is gone with the wind, unquote. The Social Security bureaucrats have been singing the same song for the last 40 years. However, Title II of the original Act of 1935 only dealt with federal old age benefits and said not one word about insurance. It's benefits, boys and girls, not insurance. Benefits, boys and girls, is welfare. Well, now that Social Security is clearly in trouble, the bureaucrats are singing a new song. Mike Naver of the Baltimore office recently said, no one, including the Social Security Administration, has ever claimed that Social Security is the same as private insurance. Unquote. Well, Mr. Naver must not be reading his own propaganda, because that's what they're still selling to this day at the Social Security office. It's a fraud. It's a lie. It isn't true. But that's what they keep telling us. It's insurance. Mr. Shiker, the current Secretary of Health and Human Services, said Social Security would go broke by 1983. Other studies indicated Mr. Shiker was pretty close to correct and supported his assessment by also predicting acute shortages by 1982 or 83, depending upon economic conditions. Remember, all of this was to happen in just the next 4 years. So if Social Security isn't a savings or an insurance program guaranteed by law, then what is it? Well, it cannot be considered savings because it is not subject to income tax. Then, is it a benefit? Well, my dictionary tells me that benefits are payments or assistance given by a public agency. Well, then Social Security must be a gift given by the benevolent federal government to its subjects. It is just another transfer scheme. It is a dole. It is a handout by the Congress of these United States, who can just as easily decide to hand you nothing. Now, we've all been told that this is our insurance, our retirement, that this is a program that has accrued benefits to us. Well, that's a lie. 'Tisn't so. 'Tisn't true. But then it's not the first time government's lied to us, is it? Nobel Prize-winning economist Professor Milton Friedman refers to Social Security as a chain letter. He said that both depend upon deceiving new participants into participating, while both simply transfer property from the new participants to the older participants. However, one can choose to participate in a chain letter or not, but one cannot, without impunity, choose to stop paying Social Security taxes. By law, these insidious taxes are withheld from your paycheck and extracted from your employer without you or your employer's consent. But if you're self-employed, or you work for a congressman, or if you're a civil service employee, or if you're working in an exempt profession like the ministry or some other railroad retirement, participation is not mandatory. Congressmen must have understood the benefits or lack thereof when they passed the law, because Congress excluded themselves. Congress is not under Social Security. They've got their own program. Now, many people think Social Security benefits benefit the lower class families, and in some ways it does. However, percentage-wise, they are the biggest contributors. You see, until 1977, if you made $26,000, Social Security would take 6%, or about $1,588. If you made $150,000, Social Security would take the same amount. But that amount is barely 1% of your total income at $150,000, but at 6% of your income at $25,000. Therefore, Social Security is regressive, and it penalizes the poor. It penalizes those who are not fortunate enough to be victimized by the Marxist graduated income tax, which is only designed and was only designed to steal from the middle class and the poor, not the rich. Now, let's look at an example to see just how bad the Social Security really is. And let's assume that we have a 21-year-old male who is forced to pay at the 1976 rate of about $900 a year. If disabled, the maximum that he could have drawn back in 1976 would have been $400 a month if he qualified. He must have been unable to return to his job for a period in excess of 1 year, and then he could not be able to perform any other type of available work. Statistically, most disabilities are for less than 8 months, and very few leave the worker totally incapable or incapacitated. And I'm positive I don't want some bureaucrat making those kinds of determinations about me. Now, a private disability plan, on the other hand, would provide $400 a month of guaranteed income and still have $837 left over. In other words, it would produce $1,200 a month. A $55,000 whole life insurance policy could be purchased that would, at age 65, have a cash value of $90,000 and pay at least $684, 50% more than the $400 a month from Social Security, and the principal would still belong to the worker. If disabled before 65, the yearly premium would be paid by the insurance company along with dividend accumulation until age 65. Now, that's a private annuity. That's private insurance. And get this. Clear back in the 70s, this is when I first realized this, is about 1968, I says, my God, this is a ripoff. Unfortunately, from 1968 to 78, I didn't know how to get out of Social Security. Now I do. And I did. And you can learn how to withdraw from Social Security also. Just write for my free General Law CD package. Remember, that's the CD package. Just go to georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and that's the place to start. Now, if you believe in Social Security, my God, don't let me get in your way. Shucks, I don't care if Mr. Begala and Ted Kennedy and everybody else want to sell Social Security and the people want to buy it. My complaint has always been, don't force me into it. Leave me out. I don't want to participate. And they come to me and say, oh, you have to participate. Why? Oh, because you won't be able to take care of yourself when you get to be an old man. And that's because we're elitists. We know what's better for you than you do, Mr. Gordon. And that's why you have to participate in Social Security. To which I say, kiss my coo, would you? boys. Now, maybe I don't know how to take care of myself, and maybe you elitists do know what's better for me, but I'd rather starve to death than to take your damn dole and your handouts. I don't want to participate. You're the ones that talk about freedom and democracy for the Iraqis, but you don't give the same freedom and democracy in America. Because we don't have the right or the freedom to choose. And that bugs me. That's why I'm making this report. Now remember, Social Security only paid $400 a month. A surviving wife would get half of that. And it steals every penny of the principal. You know, if you had this $80,000 or $90,000 in your annuity in the insurance company, you not only get twice as much money, but you get the whole annuity. When you die, you leave something for your children. Social Security takes all of it and leaves you with nothing. And while they've got it, they only pay you half as much as you'd get in a private annuity. Now, if George Bush is saying, let's establish some private accounts, and let's put our money into life insurance, and let's put our money into annuities. I mean, that's about as safe as you can get. Now, what I've been hearing from the news is that they want us to invest our money in stocks, and it'll amount to about $130 billion a year going into the stock market. God, that's wonderful. And Paul Begala hits the nail on the head when he says Bush and his cronies want to take the money and give it to big business, the brokerage houses. Well, thank God Paul Begala is there to point it out. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Begala. I appreciate you telling me that. I think you're right. Now, Mr. Begala, help me get my freedom of choice back, would you? I agree with you. I don't want to invest my money in the stock market. It would be better for us if the government really thought that we were so damn dumb and couldn't take care of our money, if they would take our money and invest it in U.S. government debt. You know, those treasury bonds, instead of selling it to the Chinese and the Japanese, sell it to the American public. Give it to us and pay us the 5% back. And every 14 years, our money will double. And then we'll have a real savings and annuity program. The national debt of America will belong to Americans, and we'll be collecting 5%. Of course, we'll be paying it all in, because that interest on the debt has to be paid as a part of operating expenses, but at least that would finance it. Now, the Democrats bring up a good point here. They say, how are you going to pay for the transition costs? Transition costs. Good point. I was listening to Vice President Cheney the other day, and he says, we'll just borrow the money. Oh. So if we borrow the money, won't that add to inflation so that we can get back cheaper dollars in the future? We pay in a dollar and get back 50 cents? God, that makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? All right, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll be back tomorrow night, and we'll take it up right here next time. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Law School. That's the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All right, we're out of time. There's a signal that says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.